Good morning, Nexus Online. It's great to be with you. Hope you're all doing incredibly well. Another Sunday morning here, and we're on our fifth week of Lent, heading towards Easter, getting there. And this Lenten season for me has been interesting because my own personal faith journey has had me in search this Lent season for a richer prayer vocabulary. I've been in search of prayers that are wiser than ones that I can muster up on my own, while also trying to find prayers that are earnest towards where I am in life. And thus far, over the past 5 weeks, it's been a very rewarding experience trying to find a deeper prayer vocabulary, you could say. But then this week, I came across a prayer that stopped me dead in my tracks. Now, the prayer is compelling to me, and yet it scares me deeply, and I don't think it's a prayer I can pray in earnest. Well, why is that? Let me back up before I get to the prayer, tell you some things that you probably already know about me. You see, Kristen and I, we were chatting a little while back, and I said to her about this mutual person that we both know. I said, you know, Kristen, I get the sense that that person doesn't like me. And as we got to chatting, Kristen was like, you know what? I get that sense too. I don't think that person likes you very much, Brad. And I said to Kristen, well, is it because I've done something? Like, do I need to make amends? And, you know, went through. I didn't feel I'd done anything. And Kristen said, you know, I think she just might not like you. Your personality, the air you carry. And this was shocking to me. I was like, what are you talking about? What would somebody not like about me? And she said, do you really want to go there, Brad? Do you want to go there? I said, yeah, what would be something that people wouldn't like about me? She said, well, to start, Brad, you can be incredibly loud. And I was like, what are you talking about? I can be loud. She's like, see, right there, you got loud. She proceeded to tell me that at times I can be, you know, when you run into a person, they're wearing earbuds, you start talking to them, and you're like, hey, how you doing? They're like, hey, hello, because they can't hear you. They talk loud. And Kristen was like, you know, I think some people find that off-putting, Brad. Your sort of volume level is always turned up a little bit louder than everyone else's. I'm like, well, that, I don't know about that. What else about me? She said, well, Brad, I think you come across to people as kind of pesky. You're a pesky little villain. I'm like, what does that even mean? And she used this example. She said, Brad, your whole personality is basically like a picnic, a warm summer day picnic along with mosquitoes. I'm like, what are you I couldn't quite get what she was comprehending there, but something apparently about my personality can grate on people. And we kept chatting, and I was just like, wow, this is quite the revelation to me. There was a sting about this conversation because in my heart of hearts, I'm like George Costanza. I believe everyone should like me. I want to be liked in life. I want to be loved. I want to be praised. I want to be approved of by others. And my guess is I'm not alone. I think all of us, probably to varying degrees, right, want the affection and the approval of others. We want to be respected. We want to be esteemed. We want to be seen in a flattering light. And I know this is true of me. So when Kristen said, I think there's just something about you, maybe this person doesn't like it, I was like, oh, that is something to think about. But then this conversation happened not long before I ran into this prayer. And I didn't even know what to do with it because I was quite certain when I first encountered it, there's no way I could pray it with sincerity. And yet, while the prayer scares me, I also find it incredibly compelling. This prayer is called the Litany of Humility. And let me read it to you and ask yourself as I read it to you, if this is a prayer you could pray in earnest. O Jesus, meek and humble of heart, hear me. From the desire of being esteemed, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being loved, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being extolled, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being honored, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being praised, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being preferred to others, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being consulted, deliver me, O Jesus. From the desire of being approved, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being humiliated, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being despised, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of suffering rebukes, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being culminated, deliver me, O Jesus. from the fear of being forgotten, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being ridiculed, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being wrong, deliver me, O Jesus. From the fear of being suspected, deliver me, O Jesus. That others may be loved more than I, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be esteemed more than I, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That in the opinion of the world, others may increase and I may decrease, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be chosen and I set aside, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be praised and I go unnoticed, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may be preferred to me in everything, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. That others may become holier than I, provided that I may become as holy as I should, Jesus, grant me the grace to desire it. I mean, here's the thing. That is a lofty prayer, and I don't think I can pray it, at least not with any sort of sincerity, because I do want to be liked. I want to be esteemed and praised and preferred, and yet I also find something incredibly compelling about that prayer, because I do want to be humble. And so praying for humility like that seems like a good place to start, but the idea that my desires to be liked, loved, respected, approved of will simply disappear seems so far-fetched to me. And so I guess the question I want to ask this morning, dive in, Lent week 5, is there a way to actually pursue humility in a way that is honest about our natural desires as humans? And this is a bit of a winding path that I want to take this week, but hang with me here. I want to suggest that humility is best found through encounters with the sublime. And to get there, I want to take a peek at Jesus' temptations. I want to take a look at Jesus' temptations on Good Friday as well. But I want to take a look at Jesus' temptations because there's an aspect of them that I think gets ignored, and I find it interesting. And of course, I think the story of Jesus' temptations are familiar to many of us. After Jesus is baptized, he's compelled by the Spirit to head out into the wilderness for 40 days. And there he prays and he prepares himself for ministry. And while in the wilderness, serpentine thoughts and temptations come to Jesus. He's tempted by the Satan. And the substance of his temptations are of great interest to me. We find this in Matthew 4. The Satan, if you are the Son of God, he says to Jesus, tell these stones to become bread. The second temptation, then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you are the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down. Third temptation, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give to you, he said, if you will bow down and worship me. Now, those temptations, those are the temptations that Jesus faced. And of course, Jesus ends up resisting all three of the temptations. But I want to ask two questions about them. First, what was the essence of Jesus' temptations? And second, how did he resist them? Now, there's a lot of ground to tread here, and you could preach on this in many different ways. For instance, in my mind, I think the essence of Jesus' temptation, it ultimately comes down to identity, right? When he is baptized, before he's sent out into the wilderness, God pronounces over him, you are my son, whom I take delight in whom I am well pleased. And what is the note, what is the word that the Satan uses? If you're the Son of God, there's a test of his identity there, right? If you're the Son of God, then why not turn stones into bread? Why not jump off this tower? Why not have authority over all the world? And so the essence of them is about identity, but inherent within the temptations as well are questions about how power is used and if the means justifies the ends. But there's another layer within these temptations that I think take us back to the question of humility and our own propensities to desire that people like us, approve of us, hold us in high esteem. All of these temptations speak to how Jesus will be perceived. And so they all speak to the very real human need to find like, approval, esteem, praise. And it's as if the Satan is sort of saying, Jesus, you want people to like you, right? Well, then feed them. Solve world hunger. Feed the masses, and you will be esteemed. People will adore you. Or Jesus, you want to be liked, right? Well, then make yourself a celebrity. Make yourself a spectacle. Throw yourself off this tower. Unmistakable. You will carry the unmistakable scent of power and fame and celebrity. People will adore you, Jesus. It was the same with the final temptation, right? It's like, you want people to love you, Jesus? Here, I'll give you the power to rule over the entire world. You can rule over the world as some sort of benevolent dictator. They will love you. It'll be like nothing they've ever seen before. You want people to like you, right, Jesus? So to me, within the temptations is a question of humility. If what you really want, the Satan seems to be saying, if what you really want, Jesus, is people's hearts, then follow my suggestions. Feed them, dazzle them, rule over them with benevolence. Of course, you'll have sold your soul, but you'll have what you want most, Jesus, the heart of the people. And Jesus resists. Yes, he wants the heart of the people, but if it means compromising himself, you know, sort of meandering away from his mission and purpose, then no, he's not going to go there. To resist these temptations, he has to rid himself of the need to be liked, adored, approved, loved. But how does he do it? Now, it's easy to sort of chalk this up to, well, Jesus was God, he can do anything. That's not so helpful for you and I. How does Jesus do it? A couple things. First of all, he knows the scripture better than the devil. The devil can quote scripture, so remember that next time somebody quotes you some scripture. Anyone can quote scripture, including the devil. Well, he seems to know and do a better job of interpreting the scriptures than Satan, fair enough. He's also rooted in his identity, fair enough. But what I want to argue this morning is that Jesus spending 40 days in the wilderness is not incidental to the matter. I want to argue this morning that Jesus was able to resist these temptations precisely because he spent time in the wilderness. In fact, I believe Jesus faced his temptations in the wilderness because the wilderness put him in touch with the sublime. And being in touch with the sublime is an incredible spiritual tool for humility and other things. To be in touch with the sublime helps us become and stay true to who we really are. But how so? And what do I mean by the sublime? Well, the Irish philosopher Edmund Burke, in his book, A Philosophical Inquiry into the Sublime and Beautiful, he begins by making this crucial distinction between beautiful things and sublime things. Beautiful, he argues, as a category, is easy to understand. There's an aesthetic aspect to beauty that we all sort of get. We all have our own specific taste. We love what is beautiful to us because it signifies, you know, safety or health or good order, whatever it is. The beautiful, according to Burke, is what is well-formed and aesthetically pleasing, whereas the sublime is what has the power to both compel and destroy us. The sublime is the dual emotional quality of fear and attraction. You see, for me, Jesus heading to the wilderness is much more than the setting, just the setting or the backdrop of the scene and drama here. The wilderness, you could almost say, is actually a character in the story. The wilderness represents Jesus encountering the sublime. How so? Notice Mark's depiction of what happens here. It says this in Mark chapter 1. At once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days being tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. Now notice how this sets up the qualities of the sublime. The sublime has the power to both destroy and compel. It has the power to attract and produce fear. So Jesus is compelled by the Spirit to go to the wilderness. So there's the attraction, the compulsion. But what does Jesus find there? Wild animals. Fear. You have to remember, when we think about the landscape Jesus headed into, this desert landscape Jesus put himself into was a scary one. To start, it was largely uninhabitable. It was full of dangers to anyone who dared to venture in it for long. I mean, there was the danger of scorching heat during the day and, you know, extreme cold by night, and of course, danger from wild animals. And while it's not the same now, in Jesus' time, lions, bears, poisonous snakes, scorpions, they all inhabited the region that Jesus would have been in. And on top of that, there's scarcity of food and water. I think you could say this, the landscape that Jesus heads into is not forest bathing or a scenic stroll. It's a daunting landscape. And it produces for Jesus both a compulsion and a fear, both psychological and physical. There's the fear of natural forces. And in that setting, the psychological fears of Jesus emerge, his own serpentine thoughts, his own unique temptations. But at the same time, the landscape is strikingly, hauntingly beautiful. I remember when I was with a few friends in the U.S. Southwest and we were visiting a Wolfman petroglyph, and we had to go down some dirt road a bunch of ways. We were in the middle of nowhere, backcountry, and got finally parked at the trailhead, hiked all this down to this huge cliff, and there's a petroglyph, an ancient petroglyph, on this rock wall, massive petroglyph, probably about 1,000 years old. And we're staring at it. We hike down to it. It's wonderful. It's absolutely beautiful part of the U.S. Southwest, this area. And there's no one around. And we're staring, just taking it all in. And as we start to look around, my friend John says, "My goodness, I've just discovered a mountain goat carcass." And as we sort of investigated and took a look, this thing had clearly been taken out by some sort of predator. And the moment that realization dawned on us, because this hadn't been there for weeks, this looked relatively fresh. It was like immediately in this beautiful, haunting landscape, immediately the hairs went up on the back of our neck like, oh my goodness, is there a mountain lion in the vicinity? And when you're alone and away from people, distant in the backcountry, that is a very scary prospect. And so that Jesus heads into the wilderness with the wild animals, as Mark says, into this unforgiving landscape that is harsh and hard to live from and yet achingly beautiful. It's not incidental to the story that this is the setting, because what Jesus is encountering is the sublime. And I'm convinced that Jesus learns humility and finds the strength to resist inappropriate uses of power, the need for people to like him, by being in touch with the sublime, by being in this place that is both terrifying and hauntingly beautiful. And I believe it's the same for us. Where will we learn humility? Where will we learn as humans to resist inappropriate uses of power? Where will we learn to lay down our need to be liked and esteemed? Well, head to the places that we find both frightening and compelling. And I think there are many ways we could work this out, right? It could be a people group. It could be a prayer. It could be a vocation that both seems beautiful and terrifying, but so often we find what we need in the spiritual life, I would say, at the intersection, the borderlands, the nexus of what we fear and what compels us. Find what is both scary and attractive to us. And you know, there's a lot of work that you can do in sort of this area in terms of metaphor and how that applies to our lives. What are those things that's scary, beautiful? But I don't want to relegate the wilderness to just a metaphor yet. I think Jesus spending time in the harsh, actual wilderness is actually important on its own. I mean, consider this. The more and more urban we become, the more these experiences become lost to us. Studies have shown today that children, our children, children my age, they spend half as much time outside as we did when we were kids. And adults today spend 90% of their lives indoors. I mean, are we missing something? And of course, we all know that being outdoors can be beneficial. It lowers heart rates, lowers cortisol levels. But what I'm talking about here is much more than the health equivalent, right, of taking a bubble bath or forest bathing. I'm not talking about a stroll through the woods. I'm talking about the wilderness as a place that is both compelling and terrifying. There's something, I would say, almost essential about encountering the sublime through nature, at least. I mean, consider this. The poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, he used to stand on the edge of cliffs in order to induce vertigo in himself. He considered it a spiritual tonic. The naturalist John Muir would prescribe himself crashing waterfalls, being at the base of crashing waterfalls, as a spiritual exercise. Encounters with the sublime have been for poets and spiritualists and naturalists and peoples of faith. It's been a vial of spiritual tonic, you could say, for centuries and millennia. And so whether it's height-based vertigo or crashing waterfalls or laying on your back and taking in a starry night, observing a herd of wild animals, say in the Serengeti, staring into the expanse of a parched desert, many people throughout the centuries have sought to provoke in themselves an experience, you could say, of religious ecstasy almost, a dose of sublimity. Michael Harris, he picks up on this in his book, All We Want, and he writes this: the outdoors can ravish and attack. It can bowl us over and dominate the senses. An urbanized humanity forgets how violent, how knock you down the natural world can be. But we remember again those rare moments when the storm bellows, when the glacier looms, when we encounter the sublime. I mean, why is it from the psalmists in the Old Testament, the psalmists like David, to the prophets like Hosea, Jesus himself, all the way down to people like John Muir, people, women like Cheryl Strayed, people continue to seek the sublime in nature. Why? Well, again, Edmund Burke, Irish philosopher, he wasn't content to just define the differences between the sublime and beautiful. He wanted to know, what is it that draws us as humans to crashing waterfalls, cliff ledges, roaring storms, harsh landscapes? Why do we do that? Why do we seek out places that are both attractive and scary to us? Because he found this to be perplexing to him, because the sublime by its nature is overpowering. And in general, we humans try to avoid what is overpowering. So why in the world would we sometimes enjoy it, seek it out? Well, in general, what exactly the psychological and spiritual benefits are these. There are about three good reasons why we seek out the sublime. It's because of the effects that they have. Consider this. First, the sublime humbles us. The enormity of the sublime can put our little worries into context and can make human troubles appear inconsequential. In other words, when we stand in front of something sublime, say a panoramic vista or a crashing waterfall, or when we find ourselves in the middle of a desert landscape, the experience of those moments, it diminishes us. We feel small. We might even feel scared. We might even feel powerless. It's as though our existence is so puny considering the grandeur of nature. And when that happens, what can happen is it diminishes our worries as well. All the trappings of consumer culture, for example, they begin to look pointless. And the little things we worry over or obsess over, like if someone likes you, suddenly start to seem small. Not to matter much. I mean, consider the Grand Canyon. Nobody that I know of stands next to the Grand Canyon and says, you know, I'm worried that so-and-so doesn't like me. I mean, I've stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon and I love listening to conversations when I'm in crowds. Standing at the Grand Canyon, you know what I never heard somebody say once? Hey, I'm wondering if we should buy a bigger house. Should we get a bigger TV? Should we add Disney Plus as one of the streaming services? You know, that comment that waiter said made me so angry. You don't hear those things in the face of the sublime. And why? Because perspective's gained. Almost all of the things that occupy our minds most, all the things that worry or stress us most in life in front of the sublime, they almost feel ridiculous. what the sublime has the power to do is pop our overinflated egos, egos that dupe us into thinking that the world revolves around us, egos that tempt us to believe our concerns and anxieties and our stressors, that they matter in the grand scheme of things. And so you could say this about the sublime. The sublime provides a healthy self-negation, a healthy humility. And here's the reality. I don't think Jesus could have resisted the temptations he did without the presence of the sublime. You know, maybe you catch Jesus strolling through Jerusalem at a moment like that, and maybe the need to be liked and loved would have overpowered him at that moment. I don't know. But in the face of sublime, the concerns about how he is perceived by others melts away. The temptation for power, the temptation for fame and celebrity in the face of the sublime, it doesn't work. And, you know, I don't think this is just, you know, hearing me here, this isn't just spiritual posturing. I mean, neurobiological studies have shown over and over again that the parts of the brain that are connected with self-awareness, that they're deactivated during intense experiences of the sublime. In studies in front of sublime things, subjects, they simply lose their ego. And so what philosophy and neuroscience and naturalism and scripture point to is that a dose of the sublime can sort of wrench us free from our stubborn patterns, our narrow focus and concerns in life. In the face of elemental powers, you could say we are put unabashedly in our place. But there's something quizzical here, because while the sublime humbles us, paradoxically, the sublime also lifts us up. It elevates us. You could say this: the sublime can open a liminal space where the individual and the transcendent briefly merge. You know, in the Celtic tradition, right, of course, there are thin places. Everywhere on earth, heaven and earth are 3 feet away from each other and invisible, but there are some places, sublime places, where heaven and earth are only the distance of a piece of paper away. Thin places. Linda Marie Brooks, in her book, The Menace of the Sublime to the Individual Self, she says that when we stand in front of something like the Grand Canyon or that massive mountain or the waterfall, she says this, we experience a type of mental swelling, expanding, as it were, to meet and embrace a part of the object's power. In those moments when we realize the world is greater than we ever supposed, we are also amazed to find that our ability to perceive that greatness is itself greater than we ever supposed. And this is not simply a thrill. It is a profoundly useful education. In my mind, the greatest painter, the person who could capture the sublime perhaps better than anyone else, is Caspar David Friedrich. And what he tried to communicate in his art was that the reason we go to the mountains or to the ocean or to the desert is we're seeking more than just rest and relaxation. These travel endeavors are not just vacations. We go to sublime locations seeking answers. You could say we're looking for a framework for our fragility as humans. We're searching for God. And in his portrait, Monk by the Sea, I love it. What is he doing here? Alone, we can tell he is standing. He's created this portrait of this man, this monk, standing in a place of incredible beauty. But the image is not only beautiful, it's also scary. He's facing down a storm. We can see this distant storm galloping toward the very rock he stands on. And in this way, Caspar finds a way here to capture the sublime, the beauty and the terror, the compulsion and the fear. One of my favorite art teachers, art critics, is of course Sister Wendy Beckett, and I love what she says about this piece. This is Sister Wendy Beckett. At one reading, it is a naturalistic image of sky, shore, sea, and a figure standing there alone. It needs no great insight to see the symbolic force of this. But the figure is a man of God, and he presents himself alone before the great drama of nature. He turns his back on the semi-cultivated enticements of flower and field as he stands on the barren sands, confident in the human ability to accept the immensity of the world, without flinching and without diminishment as a human being. Monk by the Sea conveys the sublime translucency of nature's forces and portrays a world that speaks to us of a mystery beyond it. In the sense of this picture, we are all monks, and we all stand on the shore of the unknown. And in this way, the sublime also functions as the great revealer. It reminds us of the great mystery that is life and faith. You see, the sublime, it reveals something beyond us, a grand design or mystery that we're not, as humans, completely privy to. In the person of faith, right, the Christian might call that God, but even people without faith have names for it. They might call these sublime encounters, they might use words like, it was majestic, haunting, or deeply moving. And yet the funny thing is there's no objective reason why this should be so. Why a waterfall moves us in such profound ways and a concrete sidewalk doesn't? Well, that's not intuitively obvious. And I mean, this is unique to the human species because you know what else you don't find at the Grand Canyon, on the rim of the Grand Canyon? You don't see lines of animal tourists. You don't have a beaver there, right, going, hey, I traveled all the way from Ontario because I just had to see this once before I died, right? Animals don't share that same compulsion towards the things that scare and attract us. And so these sublime encounters reveal and remind us of the great mystery that is life and death and everything in between. The sublime reminds us that there is something deeper, deeper at work in our world. And you know, Albert Einstein hit on this boldly, and I realized that if you're on social media, you see an Einstein quote, there's a good chance he probably didn't say it. It can be a bit dubious quoting Einstein. He gets attributed with a lot of things. So I double and triple check this. He did actually say this, but I think he hits on this boldly and quite poignantly. He says this, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom the emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. The insight into the mystery of life, coupled though it be with fear, has also given rise to religion. To know what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which our dull faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This knowledge, this feeling is at the center of true religiousness. The sublime is a teacher that unsettles us. It keeps us curious, keeps us living in the mystery." And again, I've got nothing against forest bathing or scenic strolls, but this is more than that. This is more than just chasing some goosebumps, some chills, maybe a change of heart rate. To look for and seek out the sublime is to pursue humility. It's to find the gap between heaven and earth, paper thin, and it's to remind ourselves of the incredible mystery we live in. And so, I implore you, seek out the sublime. You know, I started this morning by sharing a prayer that I don't yet have the courage to pray. It's too much, and I'm not sure I can do it with sincerity. But I want to tell you my intention this summer, be it in the desert, in the mountains, by the ocean, hopefully all three. My plan is to take this prayer with me in staring into the sublime. I hope I find the courage to pray that prayer. And so as we close this morning, may you find yourself in the coming weeks, into the summer, in the next couple of months, encountering the sublime. Whether it's skinny dipping under a starlit sky, hiking to the base of a waterfall, standing on some mountain peak, or in the peril of the terrain of wild animals, may you find the sublime, and may you find in it humility, mystery, and transcendence. Friends, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time and energy. For this week, go in peace.